Greetings. You are listening to the Northeast Ohio AFSC Weekly Audio Podcast. I'm Greg Coleridge. It is Friday, April the 29th. Thanks so much for listening. We seek every week to, as we say, inform you about issues you feel are important, update you about past and upcoming AFSC plans and activities, and inspire you, hopefully, to take action. It is, after all, grassroots social movements made up of well-informed, prepared, and motivated people that always create real change. We had a pretty active week this past one, connected to four different events. The first was last weekend with the meeting, as it is almost becoming a weekly occurrence, this being last Sunday, of the People's Justice and Peace Convention planning group that is, of course, planning an alternative convention to lift up issues and solutions not being brought up, we think, at the RNC, nor actually at the DNC, which will take place, Republican National Convention, Democratic National Convention, this summer in July. So that planning meeting occurred. Another one is coming up, which I'll mention in a moment, this weekend. Plans are in the works. We have finalized and secured a location for the event Friday and Saturday, that being July 15th and 16th, will be at Olivet Institutional Baptist Church on Quincy Avenue in Cleveland, and the 17th, Sunday, since we can't have it, of course, in a church on a Sunday, will take place at the Masonic Auditorium on 36th, I believe it is, and Euclid in Cleveland. So, many more details to come. We are shortly going to have a flyer up and website live, which we will pass along as soon as that's up. So that was Sunday. There was then Tuesday, Monday actually, Genevieve Mitchell, who is with the Carl Stokes Brigade, and myself, both of us also happen to be the designated or drafted spokespersons for the People's Justice and Peace Convention, was on internet radio interview on Who Has the Power radio network. You can find that at whohasthepowershow.com. We were on, goodness, that'd be a good hour and a half between Genevieve. The program itself is from 7 to 9 p.m., but we came on about 7:30 and spoke and commented and discussed with Mr. Yancey, the host, a range of issues related directly and indirectly about the issues, the strategies, the history, the current situation in Cleveland, what's happening nationally related to peace and justice and nonviolence and democracy across the board. So a pretty extensive interview that hopefully will soon be archived. I haven't checked today, but wasn't as of yesterday. WhoHasThePowerShow.com. That was on Monday evening, the 25th. On Wednesday, I spoke about the issues of connecting economic and political justice at the UU church out in Rocky River called West Shore Unitarian Universalist Church. That congregation is participating in a national effort within the Unitarian Universalist Association looking at the issue of inequality. And to their credit, they are not only simply examining the question of economic inequality, but connecting it as it needs to be connected to the arena of political inequality. You know, economics and politics at one time used to be part of virtually the same academic discipline. Hard to separate the two. In fact, the actual definition of political economy is one that intersects examining, theorizing, developing proposals around economics, politics, and the law, which is, I think, absolutely essential, and why, in fact, our program with AFSC focuses on politics, political, and economic justice, because we are examining each of those issues around economic justice and injustice, political justice and injustice, and certainly legal and constitutional rights and those who should not have, or entities that should have, no inalienable constitutional rights. The intersection between the two is inextricable, and such were the comments offered and discussion that followed at the UU Church. Last evening was a two events, actually, that we had some kind of participation in. I attended a meeting sponsored by the American Postal Workers Union local on Carnegie Avenue in Cleveland. They are working with a variety of organizations, both postal-related labor, other labor organizations, and community groups, to sponsor what will be one of five national hearings, at least five, but at this point scheduled to be five national hearings on the possibility of trying to save, in general, the postal system from having it be completely privatized and corporatized, but more specifically around conceiving of the idea of reintroducing what at one time was the law and was utilized by many people for many a decade, and that is being postal banks, in which you, when you went into your post office, you not only had your mail services provided and met, but also some basic elementary banking services of being able to deposit and withdraw funds. That is the idea behind trying to resuscitate and create in the 21st century a postal banking system. This was the law in the United States between 1911 and I believe it was 1967. We have certainly brought up postal banking through our monetary literacy work and our monetary history calendar, looking at how it created. Its antecedents actually go all the way back to the Populist Party and the Omaha Convention and the Omaha Platform in 1892, where the rural radical farmers, in looking at the social, political, and economic conditions around them, pegged banks and railroads as among the most nefarious and anti-democratic institutions for society in general and farmers in specific. And among their proposals for fundamental change way back in 1892 was the creation they proposed back then as encompassed and contained in this thing called the Omaha Platform, which became sort of the basic policy platform of the People's Party, postal banking. It took a number of years between 1892 and 1911 for that to become law, but it happened because of organizing, education, and political pressure. So much is to be thought of, learned from, and hopefully replicated for the 21st century today. So that was the meeting. There is a planned public hearing that previously was mentioned that will take place in June. In fact, that is scheduled to be the Cleveland hearing on June 28th. We'll mention it certainly again closer to the event, but at June 28th, beginning at 6 o'clock at East Mount Zion Baptist Church at the corner of East 100th and Euclid, will be this public hearing. I will be testifying, as others will be, about this whole idea of creating national bank. What are the impediments to it? You don't have to be a PhD in economics or political science to understand how the banking industry, financial industry in this country does not, would not, and will not look kindly at potential competitors that have low overhead and is not fraught with corruption like the banking industry is. Just basically a criminal enterprise at this point, at least among the largest too big to exist banking institutions in the United States anyway, but also in many other countries. Anyway, so that was that meeting, and then on the same evening at Cleveland Heights at the Coventry Branch Library was the current monthly meeting of the Northeast Ohio Monetary Literacy Group. The issue and subject for discussion was looking at the Canadian banking system. And even though we share a border and very much similar in culture, when it comes to banking and central banking and the democratization of money, their history is far more democratic than ours. That's what we learned a bit about, talked about, and hopefully can use as a stepping stone and a bit of literacy in continuing to advocate for more democratization and for money creation and circulation in the U.S. So those were the events of this past week. Turning now to upcoming events scheduled for next week, and there's two in particular that we will be a part of upcoming Sunday, day after tomorrow. Sunday, May 1st, May Day, is the next planning meeting for the People's Justice and Peace Convention at North Presbyterian Church at 4 p.m., address 4515 Superior Avenue. Ongoing planning for this major gathering to discuss issues and develop what we are calling a people's platform to be presented before the Republican and Democratic National Conventions, promoting peace, justice, and nonviolence. Wednesday, I will be giving a talk on corporate rights, money in elections, and move to amend at the United Steelworkers Local 979 Retirees Group at 3421 Independence Road in Cleveland. I had spoken previously a couple weeks ago to the Steelworkers Local 979 general membership meeting, as well as a subset of their local dealing with political action. So now I have a chance to go before the retirees with the hope of trying to convince or win over, at least encourage people to, at the very least, those who live in Cleveland, Shaker Heights, South Euclid, to sign their those respective petitions to get on the ballot, a move to amend resolution or a citizen initiative, I should say, if not, become more active and take a petition themselves. So that's Wednesday, May 4th at 11:30 at United Steelworkers Local 979. Well, brief comments now on recent news items relevant to our work. Three issues that I think are worthy of some reflection on this week. The first has to do with a blog posting that appeared this week on the think tank Policy Matters Ohio blog. Their posting was entitled "Foreclosures Drop But Remain Elevated." The posting stated in part that, quote, the number of new home foreclosures across Ohio dropped last year, that being 2015, but remains well above previous levels. Foreclosures, this being home foreclosures in Ohio, fell by 7.4% last year to 40,479 homes. The number of new filings at county courts across the state dropped for the sixth year in a row, to well under half the number in 2009. However, the blog posting goes on to state, during the 1990s, the number of filings averaged 21,075, or slightly over half the total in 2015. The number of foreclosures remain at least double 1995 levels in 73 of the state's 88 counties and triple that of two decades ago in 42 counties, or almost half of those counties in Ohio. Of course, Ohio has 88 counties. Ohio was hit early and hard by the predatory lending that helped bring about the last recession and forced tens of thousands from their homes. Even now, the share of home buyers who are significantly behind on their mortgages remain far higher than before the foreclosure crisis. So the blog posting goes on to talk about that Ohio is slated to receive upwards of, I think it's $192 million in additional federal funds to prevent home foreclosures and, at least on paper, stabilize the housing markets. However, there's two issues when you read this piece and see what has been going on across the state and across the country that are at root of this ongoing crisis, two issues or problems regarding the ongoing housing crisis, which actually has disproportionately hit Ohio hard, beginning in 2007, 2008, and 2009, and right up to the present time. So there's two problems. one of which centers in Columbus and the other in Washington, D.C. At the state level, as the Policy Matters piece stated, and news reports have come out and public officials have commented on, at the state level, housing advocates had hoped for much more than the $192 million the state had requested. And that had to do with the state not receiving more because its application to the federal government was flawed, focusing too heavy on the demolition of vacant homes and not enough on keeping people in their homes. So that's one problem. The other is at the federal level, where not enough money has been set aside from day one, going back to the start of the foreclosure crisis, to help average, ordinary people. Wall Street was bailed out beginning from day one, but not Main Street, meaning small businesses, nor the side streets and back streets, euphemistically, which basically define homeowners. Why? Why was Main Street and the side streets and back streets not helped commensurate to Wall Street? Well, we know why. It's the exact same reason average individuals around our state and across the country are decreasingly being helped on issue after issue, problem after problem, and crisis after crisis. And that has to do with the rigged political system, which to a great degree has to do with corporate constitutional rights and money defined as free speech, which has drowned out the voices, in this case, of people who have been losing their homes ever since the Great Recession or Great Depression, round two, depending on your situation and the community you live in, commenced in 2007 and 2008. According to OpenSecrets.org, an organization that tracks money in election, the FIRE, what is known as the FIRE sector, which we've commented on in previous podcasts, the FIRE sector, which stands for Finance, Insurance, and Real Estate, was the number one federal political contributor or investor, meaning they, above all else, finance, insurance, and real estate, contributed collectively more money to federal officials just after the financial implosion in 2008, to people running for Congress in 2008. And of course, there was a presidential campaign in 2008 as well. It remained the number one sector in 2010, 2012, 2014, and remains the number one sector, contributing or investing in political candidates and campaigns this year. In 2016, at least up to the present time. In 2008, 51% of contributions or investments went to Democrats. In 2010, 52% went to Republicans, 68% went to Republicans in 2012, 63% to Republicans again in 2014. So far this year, 64% are going to Republicans. But let's not forget, the rest are going to Democrats. And it's important to remember that President Obama was a major recipient of campaign contributions or investments from the FIRE sector in during his first campaign in 2008. And he also received money in 2012, not as much compared to Mitt Romney, but nevertheless, this, many believe, is a major reason why too-big-to-exist banks haven't been broken up, why no bank executives have been prosecuted, never mind going to jail, compared to many European bankers, why no major serious reform has been enacted, and why Wall Street and not people in Ohio losing their homes have been en masse bailed out. And it won't change unless we change the legal ground rules, which is why working on Move to Amend is a way to bring about some relief, some change, some help, if not considerable, to those who are suffering through the foreclosure crisis, and why and how and what can be done for those individuals who are suffering through so many other crises that they are dealing with in their communities, dealing with justice and democracy. Well, second issue has to do with wanting to bring listeners up to date about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We haven't commented much in recent weeks about the TPP, that being the so-called misnamed trade agreement that encompasses a dozen Pacific rimmed countries, including the United States, but also those in Asia and South America, that encompasses collectively about 40% of global trade. This is a deal that is trade in name only, but actually deals with more specifically, and I think more legitimately, if you will, or illegitimately, but more succinctly and directly and targetedly, the issue of governance, self-governance, the ability of governing bodies of executives, presidents, and congresses and parliaments to set laws and rules governing their own environment, their own regulations protecting workers, communities, the environment, consumers, you name it, citizens. This is a deal that would trump, no pun intended, national laws for decisions being made at an international level through unelected and unaccountable tribunals that have the power to overturn and have the power to, again, usurp nationally elected laws and rules, be it by Congress, be it by executives, be it by courts. That's what the so-called investor state resolution decision-making processes or panels or tribunals would do, would trump or usurp a nationally enacted law. So it's not about trade, it's about democracy or lack thereof, and has been pushed hard by corporations that had a seat at the table. About between five and 600 such corporations were those who were consulted with, but of course citizens weren't, environmental groups weren't, unions weren't, consumer organizations weren't. Even many public officials had zero access to the negotiations and to the agreements as it was being conceived until it was in final form. And even then, it was for the longest time kept secret. So much, what does that say about how legitimate it is? This is largely, however, the TPP, even though it was fast-tracked, at least the decision to create a fast-track rule was passed as a sort of a stepping stone to try to get the TPP through Congress. The TPP has largely, over the last couple of months, gone nowhere. And that's because largely due to the current elections. Not just presidential, but congressional. President Obama and TPP supporters in Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, have been facing this one problem. The American people in the U.S. who know about it don't like it and don't want it approved and are asking their candidates at the presidential level and congressional level, those running for Senate, not to support the TPP. Presidential candidates, including Sanders and Hillary Clinton, who earlier was supportive of the TPP, have, or at least was cagely sort of playing both sides, came out and said she is, at least as of now, against the TPP. Donald Trump and many Republican candidates said they were against it as well. So, and that's largely in response to the American public that have said they do not want to see this anti-democratic, so-called misnamed trade deal, Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, be approved. And the same goes for congressional candidates here in Ohio. Sherrod Brown's been a longtime opponent of trade deals that hurt workers, and TPP certainly falls into that camp. But Rob Portman has come out against it. He, a longtime supporter, he was a trade representative for the Bush administration, first Bush administration. He came out, though, against it, and largely, I believe, due in part to public opposition. And because his opponent, Ted Strickland, is against the TPP. So you have congressional candidates that are responding to public pressure against the TPP. But that hasn't slowed the push to it. President Obama has recently renewed his push for the TPP, suggesting that it will be easier to pass the deal after the elections are over. The idea is that lawmakers will then be more insulated from political influence. Ah, democracy, is it not, is a pesky thing and can get in the way, can it not, from what the powers to be, from the power elite, want and expect to happen despite what the public may dislike. Who cares about the public? Who cares about elections? Who cares about the popular will? What the power elite want, they will try to ram through, and it is up to us to not only make sure that public officials hear our opposition to the TPP before the election, but that we hold candidates accountable to their positions that they take before the election once they are elected and are in office. Now, why is it that the president is pushing so hard for this right now, especially when anti-corporate free trade agreements seem to be so strong, especially among Democrats, as evidenced during the presidential campaign? Well, yet again, it comes down to one issue: cold, hard cash. Obama has his own potential incentives to push for the TPP right now. It's not to be reelected, because he can't be reelected anymore. He's a two-termer. That's it. However, his presidential foundation has been relying on support from industries that could profit from the agreement. One of them is, as an article recent in Popular Resistance points out, the financial services industry. The TPP offers potential benefits, and I quote from the PopularResistance.org article, to the financial sector, including expanded access to capital and investment opportunities in emerging markets, as well as what critics say are provisions that could dilute financial regulation in the United States. The progressive advocacy group Public Citizen says the deal, quote, would undermine bans on particularly risky financial products and restrict capital controls, an essential policy tool to counter destabilizing flows of speculative money. The same financial industry that could benefit from the TPP has forged deep ties to Obama's foundation, unquote. So here's a few examples, as pointed out in the PopularResistance.org article, of where there is some overplay or some connection between the Obama Foundation and the financial sector. Michael Sachs, for example, chairman and CEO of the investment management firm GCM Grosvenor, has given the Obama Foundation somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million. The foundation also reports that it has received somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million from Mark Gologly, founder of the investment firm Centerbridge Partners and a former senior manager director at the Blackstone Group. The same goes for James Simons, founder of the investment management firm Renaissance Technologies, LLC. Hedge fund founder David Shaw, former UBS President Robert Wolf, and Tim Collins, CEO of the private equity firm Ripplewood Holdings, have each given between $250,000 and $500,000. Nicholas Alescas of the private equity firm Madison Dearborn Partners has given up to $100,000. That's just the financial sector. Many other sectors stand to gain if the TPP is rammed through Congress. However, resistance to these type of deals is on the rise, not just in Congress, but as previously mentioned, on the campaign trail, when individuals who are running for president, Senate, and Congress are running into their constituency. It's opposition against the TPP in this country that is becoming wider and deeper at the public level, but it's also across the world, as well as other so-called misnamed trade deals. The sister trade deal, for example, of the TPP called the TTIP, which stands for Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. Opposition to it has been rapidly increasing in Europe. This is a trade deal between the United States, misnamed, so-called, between the United States and Europe. But just during the last year alone, more than 1,300 European communities have declared themselves, quote, TTIP free zones. In Europe, resistance to the TPP is not just growing at the municipal and regional level, but next month could see the election of the continent's first openly anti-TTIP national government, where in Austria, a member state of the European Union that was already mostly opposed to the TTIP, voters just put into the presidential runoff race two candidates who vehemently oppose the deal. That's in Austria. On our side of the Atlantic, opposition to the TPP has grown to over 100 U.S. cities declaring their opposition to the TPP through resolutions, including New York City, Seattle, and Miami. So we must keep up the pressure, keep talking, writing, and acting on the TPP to join our brothers and sisters in the United States, In other TPP-related countries along the Pacific Rim, there's been opposition in those countries. FlushTheTPP.org is a good resource for information, as is the Global Trade Watch Project at Public Citizen, and their website is citizen.org/TradeWatch. Keep talking, writing, and acting on the TPP. Finally, comment on a manual that has just been published by the ACLU of Ohio. It's a guide to protesting for those of you who plan to do so at the July upcoming Republican National Convention. It is a manual that details the rights of protesters and police during the RNC. It can be found at and downloaded at acluohio.org/RNC. Take a look at it. I did so yesterday. It's a very fine piece that summarizes these categories or topics. Demonstrations and free speech, surveillance and monitoring techniques, police encounters and arrests, militarization of police, FAA regulations, police infiltration, and search and seizure. This document, a protest manual, if you will, by the ACLU, sort of lays out the rights of protesters as well as the rights of police. And it's important that we understand where the lines are, what our rights are. If we choose to cross the line, that's fine. At least we need to know where the line is when we decide if we want to or do not wish to cross the line and risk arrest by doing so. So that's what this manual seeks to outline and seeks to detail. AFSC plans at this point to focus on two projects that we've been talking about over the last couple of months related to the RNC, this previously mentioned People's Justice and Peace Convention, which will take place the 3 days before the RNC begins, as well as support for this major national march and rally called End Poverty Now, March for Economic Justice, slated to occur the first day of the convention on July 18th. There'll no doubt be many other events. This is a very helpful guide for anyone planning to be anywhere near downtown Cleveland, not just during the RNC, which is July 18 and 21, but many of these rules and regulations and rights will certainly be important to understand even the week before, since the whole area will start to be locked down well before July 18th. So know your rights. Check out the document. It, again, is at acluohio.org/RNC. That's /RNC. Again, acluohio.org/RNC. That's all for this week. Keep up with our activities. Contact us with questions, concerns, or willingness to help out. Our website is afsc.org/Akron. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/NEOAFSC. Our program blog, Northeast Ohio AFSC, .wordpress.com, my blog, createrealdemocracy.wordpress.com. Until next week onward, for justice, peace, and democracy.